Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
You know, women are hugely underrepresented in the STEM fields. In my field of physical sciences, women are about 30%. The sad part of it is some of those numbers have actually been declining over the last few years. I would strongly argue if you're not utilizing the talent of all of your population, if you're actively discouraging people from going into fields that are going to help move this country forward, help us solve things like climate change, you're not doing a good job. And the fact is, girls, a lot of people of color don't feel welcome in the sciences.
I've been in situations where I've went into meetings and people have actually thought that I was someone's assistant. And then it's pretty funny to 20 minutes later, it's like, oh, who are you? It's like, well, I actually lead the Google Lunar X Prize, which I do get a little bit of joy out of that. My advice to girls is that you can be and do whatever you want. And there's so many different areas that you can work in around this.
When I meet young girls, when I go into schools in cities, I say, you belong in the STEM fields. It's a good career. It pays good money. We need your talent. Don't you let anybody ever make you feel like you don't belong.
To go into the science field, it's been mostly driven by my passion. Once I've opened the doors, though, and reached out to science communities, I've definitely had a lot of encouragement, especially as a young person. What I want to say to women who are thinking about science is that this is something they should definitely get into. The fate of planet Earth is in their hands and something that women can definitely make a huge impact in. We need all hands on deck, and that includes a large group of women.
Jill Myers has made a career out of passion. Through her work with Dream Soar and Shasta Ways, Jill has been pushing the importance of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics by mentoring young women and extending all of herself for a cause she so passionately believes in. Tonight, on the 59th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Jill joins us via Zoom to give us her thoughts on a multitude of topics, including the importance of STEM in the 21st century, keeping the STEM movement alive, her work with Dream Soar, and why Amelia Earhart may have inadvertently started a revolution for women in STEM over 80 years ago.
I have only been able to say the following sentence once before on this show, and of course that was back when we had Scott and Forrest from Astonishing Legends on as guests. But every once in a while, I get to record the show with someone that I consider to be a friend. And today, like I said, it's the second time I get to say that. Joining me via Zoom from San Diego, California is Jill Myers. Jill is a woman that wears many hats, but she currently serves as a director of business operations for Dream Soar. And if that name sounds familiar to you, it should, because the founder of Dream Soar is none other than Shasta Ways. Jill played an instrumental role in working with us to bring Shasta and Dream Soar into the fold to the Chasing Earhart project, and she's since gone on to assist us in bringing some others to the table, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Jill, thank you for your time today, and welcome to Chasing Earhart.
Thank you, Chris. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Now, I know you've heard several of our shows, so you know what's on deck first. It's a question I refer to as housekeeping. Can you tell everyone a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
Absolutely. I started my education actually wanting to be a doctor and got sidetracked a little bit when I became enamored with aviation. When I was 13 years old, a friend of my father's took me up in a Cessna 140 tail dragger off the coast of a town north of Boston. And as soon as he took me up, I was like, you know, that's it. And at the time, I lived in Scottsdale, Arizona, and was a mile from the Scottsdale airport, which was really tiny back then. And I used to just ride my bike to the airport after school and on weekends and just made it my plan to get into aviation. So I got my pilot's license when I was 17 and joined the Air Force, although when I walked into the recruiting office with my pilot's license in hand, I got the, oh, you're a girl response. This was in the late 70s. But I joined anyway, although they wouldn't let me fly, which was kind of disappointing. But I ended up supporting aircraft in the military and did that for a little short of 10 years. And while I was in, they offered me a program, a very special program to finish college, because I had actually started college for a semester and then quit. But I got my degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Texas in Austin, still active duty Air Force at the time, and got out a few years later, and basically then just spent the next 20-something years building either aircraft or avionics. My actual engineering specialty discipline, as they call it, is systems engineering. So I was always responsible for kind of pulling together all the systems as a whole and making sure things worked together and airplanes could actually take off and fly correctly. I did putz with grad school a little bit, but I've always had jobs where I traveled a lot. So grad school, even doing online programs, was just too hard. So unfortunately, I never finished my master's. I started it at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and maybe someday I'll finish. I don't know. We'll see how things go.
You know, in all the time we've talked off air, I never knew this, but as you were talking, it occurred to me, there are some parallels there between you and Amelia Earhart. You're talking about the first time you went up and how that changed everything for you, and then you entered the Air Force and they didn't let you fly.
And, you know, sadly, it's just a testament that things haven't maybe progressed as much as they should, which, of course, is the whole point of a lot of the outreach I do and even Dream Soar. So,
and of course, that brings us now to Dream Soar. For those that don't know, Jill was very instrumental in bringing Dream Soar and Shastaways into the fold for Chasing Earhart and for our panel event that took place in July. Can we back up, though, and will you tell us how you got involved in Dream Soar? I love that story.
I will. It is a good one, isn't it?
Yes, definitely.
I was working the 2 years prior to me meeting Shasta in 2017, I was working for a company on a really neat airplane that some people may have read about called the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. And I was working on that program, really one of the most amazing airplanes I've ever worked on. And in January of 2017, I saw Shasta on the cover of the Women in Aviation International magazine, because I've been a member of WAI for, I think, 17 years now. And I saw her on the cover and I read the article. I had never met her. And when I saw the route map published, which I don't think they published until February, I was looking at her route, the original flight route, which of course changed, but and I read in the article that they were going to be planning outreach events at roughly half of these locations. And I didn't know how far they were in the planning. And as not only a longtime member of WAI, but as a chapter president, which I was at the time, president of the San Diego chapter, and I had also started a chapter back east. So I'm pretty tight with the folks at headquarters. So I had never met Shasta, but I had met one of the women who was on our board of directors at the time, and I pulled out her business card. I had met her actually at a WAI conference. And I wrote her and I said, hey, I don't know if you remember me. We met last year. I was reading this article and I said, if you want help planning some of the outreach events, I can connect you with some of the WAI chapter presidents. I know the head of the chapter in Dubai. I know the head of the chapter in Mumbai. And I just happened to have met these folks at conferences and was in touch with them. And as a chapter president, I had the secret sauce list of all of their email addresses. And at the time, there were about 110 chapters, I think. So she wrote me back and said, wow, that would be great. We'd love the help. So I started out just literally thinking I would send a few emails, you know, introduce them to some of my contacts and be on my way. And then the next thing that happened is I was invited to a very long outreach status phone call that Shasta and the outreach team were on. And I listened in on that for a while. And last April, I got a text message one day and it said, hi, this is Shasta Ways. And I would love to talk to you if you have some time today. And we got on the phone and she told me her whole story, you know, obviously herself, as to her life and her mission and her goals. And after I stopped crying, she asked me if I would take over leadership of the outreach program, which was, you know, just a stunning request. So I quit my job and decided that I would dedicate the next X number of months. At the time, we thought it was going to be 3 or 4, to helping her get around the world. And what is really interesting about the story, which a lot of people really find fascinating, is I did not meet Shasta until the night before she took off. So I was working all these outreach events. At the time, we were planning them, as I said, at about half the stops. So we ended up in the end doing 32 outreach events in 17 locations in 14 countries. But it was very clear to me that I needed to understand more about her and, you know, be in a room with her. So they formally invited me to her launch event in Daytona Beach. So I flew to Florida from California and literally met Shasta the night before her departure at a restaurant event for the team, and was there the day she took off. And it was interesting because as soon as we met, we didn't tell each other this until later, but we really felt as if we had known each other forever. There's just a very interesting deep connection between the two of us. And then once we started working together and she took off, my role grew. And I ended up not only leading all the outreach planning, but a couple weeks into the flight, they asked me to take over the coordination of all of her flight and ground logistics. And a lot of that was because, as one of the board of directors said to me, they said, look, you know, you're a licensed pilot, you're an aerospace engineer, you've been building airplanes for decades. And they asked me to kind of be her right-hand person and the primary person she contacted during her mission, because they said, you know, you'll be able to help Shasta way better and faster than the rest of us because of the blend of your experiences as a experienced pilot and as someone who knows how the airplane works. So I ended up really not sleeping for 5 months and was able to be online with Shasta through a messaging system while she was flying to be there in case she needed anything. Also, sometimes while she was flying, things related to her destination would change, so I would need to contact her. And it just became the most rewarding time of my entire life and career, not just helping Shasta as an individual, but, you know, seeing the faces of these kids when the hosts would send me photos or Shasta would provide photos of her doing the outreach and inspiring the next generation, which of course is the whole mission of our organization. So it was really, really amazing how it all came about. And it's really the most amazing thing I've ever done.
And, you know, I'm listening to that story and I'm listening for parallels. And that's one of the reasons that we wanted to have Shasta on the panel in July, is because there are so many parallels between Shasta and Amelia, really. As I've pored over Amelia's career in these last 10 years, one of the things that's become evident to me is this idea that Amelia was a pioneer of STEM without ever knowing what STEM would fully become. And one of the questions I've been wanting to get your thoughts on is, Dream Soar in particular, as an organization and as a mission, how do you think this is a continuation of Amelia's legacy when it comes to inspiring young women to get into STEM?
Yeah, I think there is a definite parallel, Chris. And it was interesting. One of the things that I recently learned about Amelia was that way back in her day, she was already questioning, why are only girls going to the cooking classes and the boys are going to the shop classes? And you know, now we obviously still even ask that question, but I think a lot of the parallels are that both Amelia and Shasta, eventually through Dream Soar, are really all about just getting rid of those barriers and, you know, making it really clear that the gender really doesn't matter and shouldn't matter. And it was really interesting to see and read more about Amelia doing that in the day. And, you know, I do a lot of public speaking about women in aviation and aerospace engineering. And I've started in the last year to use a quote that I think really fits them both, Shasta and Amelia. Sally Ride once said, "You can't be what you can't see." And I think a lot of that is that until Amelia and people like her and her flight instructor and, you know, Louise Thaden and other people of that era, until they got up in an airplane and flew and landed and got out and people went, wow, that's a girl. The same as Shasta stepping out of the airplane and people looking at her going, where's the pilot? You just really need to make it known that you really can be anything you want to be if you work hard. And if you just keep pushing through, and there are many examples of that philosophy. But I think Amelia probably pushed it harder in her day than maybe others, because she did get out in front of the public more, I think, and obviously had some world records that were quite known internationally, obviously. And then with Shasta doing her flight and her mission, and, you know, I always tell people when I talk about Shasta, especially right now, one of my primary roles for her is to be the point person for all of the organizations who want her to come and be a keynote speaker, which, you know, the phone's basically been ringing off the wall for, you know, 10 months. But what I tell people is there's really no one better on this earth to stand up in front of young girls, especially, and send that message than Shasta Ways. You know, she stands up and talks about being shy as a young girl. You know, she's still, I think, a little leaning toward the shy side, even with all of her. She's a phenomenal public speaker, but there's definitely a shyness underneath there. But for Shasta to get up and talk about her journey from being born in an Afghan refugee camp to where she is today, and to be so humble about it, I think is really what sends that message. And, you know, just as an example, we were at an event in Long Beach, California in February where Shasta was up, and I was lucky to be there in person with her. She was addressing a group of about 500 high school kids. And after she did her presentation, she was getting ready to ask everyone if they wanted to ask her any questions. And the first thing she said is, you know, don't be shy like I was. Go ahead and raise your hand. I mean, it was great. And so I think, you know, just Amelia getting out there and doing things her own way and not letting anyone tell her no, which is exactly what Shasta represents. I think those are the biggest parallels that I see.
So let's talk about this. You have Amelia Earhart in 1937 with the World Flight Attempt that inspires her generation and every generation since then. And you have a legend like Ann Pellegrino, who completed the World Flight in 1967. You have Amelia Rose Earhart in 2014. And now Shasta is taking the ball and running with it. How important do you think it is for women to keep this up and to keep trying to push the boundaries of aviation for following generations?
That's a great point, and I do think it's super important, and here's why. So with all the decades that I've been doing outreach and doing mentoring and all of that, it's very evident that there aren't enough role models, and the percentages of women in aviation are still so dreadfully low. You know, the percentage of women that are licensed pilots in the world, regardless of type of rating, is 6%. The percentage of women airline pilots, I believe, is now at 4.5 or 5. And in other fields as well, the percentage of women air traffic controllers is 16%. And the lowest one is the percentage of women in aircraft maintenance is 2%, just gone down from 3. So I think it's extremely important that women continue to get out there and do amazing things in addition to, quote, day-to-day flying in their regular jobs, just because of what I said earlier, you can't be what you can't see. So if young girls don't see women out there doing these amazing things, it may not strike them that it's possible. So the more people that do these brave things, like Shasta has done, like other Earth Rounders and other long-duration flights, the women who do the air races, all of that, it's just the more we get women out there in the public, on the news, doing these amazing things, and even outside of aviation, you know, the women who are really breaking ground in firefighting, and, you know, there's a lot of different fields, so I think it's just a matter of we do need some of these big events like Shasta going around the world because it will make the news and it will get more in front of people. And I just think that we need more of that to continue to set examples for young girls.
Is it really surprising to you that Dream Soar and specifically Shasta has received the recognition that's been received? This is a woman whose award list grows almost on a weekly basis at this point. When she was on the show, I rattled off a list of awards that you provided for me when we went on. And of course, she's got zero ego about the whole thing, which also doesn't surprise me. That's the measure of the woman. But is all of this surprising to you?
It may be surprising to the general public because some of the response we get from people, not frequently, but sometimes people will say, well, you know, Jill, a lot of people have flown around the world. And my response is always, absolutely, a lot of people have flown around the world, even solo, but not a single person, to my knowledge, and I've talked to people in the Earth Rounders organization in New York, I don't believe anybody before Shasta Ways has flown around the world for really the sole purpose of meeting with young kids and letting them know that they can be whatever they want to be. You know, other Earth Rounders didn't have the pressure Shasta had while flying around the world of knowing that there was a long list of scheduled outreach events that she needed to hit. Now, with that said, one of my primary roles in support of Shasta during her flight was to make sure that I took care of all of that for her. So if she had a day where she, rightfully so, as not only pilot in command, but as one of the safest pilots I've ever met, if she would decide not to fly on a scheduled day because of weather, for example, and that caused me to call, you know, 12 cities and reschedule outreach, we just did that. And that's the piece that's not been done before. So I'm not surprised at the accolades she's getting, at the awards she's getting, at the number of invitations to be a keynote speaker. I think it's okay to share publicly that I'm handling her public speaking events right now. And my current spreadsheet of requests for Shasta to speak around the world now numbers 86. We have 86 organizations call starting from last summer, even before she completed her global flight, to ask her to come and either meet with kids, or there was an event in Chicago in April, for example, where she went and spoke to 700 STEM educators about the importance of diversity in STEM. So it is, I think, a little surprising of the volume of calls that we've had and requests for her, but I don't think it's so much a surprise because what she's done is unique. And in fact, the other thing amazing, in addition to the Smithsonian Award for Current Achievement she got in March, around the same time, we made an announcement that Shasta had been signed on as a speaker for the National Geographic Speakers Bureau. And when Shasta and I first met with the woman who is our representative at National G, Shasta looked at her and said, you know, basically, why me? And the person's response was, you know, because you are one in a million. And I've heard that from people many times, including the Smithsonian, saying there just is no one like Shasta. No one has the combination of her background and her passion and her initiative and her successes all rolled up in one.
What I really love about you is your willingness to make connections for various projects. As I said, you brought us Shasta and Dream Soar, but you also recently brought us Behedu, who I am personally in love with, and she will be our landmark 60th episode guest next week. Can I ask you what that's like for you to be able to bring people together with projects that you care about?
Oh, it's my absolute favorite thing to do. I've been very fortunate to meet amazing women, well, people in general, but I've just gotten to know by happenstance sometimes really amazing, amazing women, and there's nothing I love more than connecting them. So there's a few organizations I've been extremely honored to help out in addition to Chasing Your Heart. One is an organization, there's a film company called Indie Atlantic Films in Florida. The director of this film I'll tell you about, her name's Katie McIntyre Wyatt, and they are producing and developing a documentary called Fly Like a Girl that will tell the whole story of women in aviation all the way through time. And what they're doing is they've spent over a year, and I've been supporting them, I guess, for 2 years, in fact. And when I first read about them, I started hooking up with Katie. And I'm very proud to say I've been able to connect them with quite a few people. They've interviewed Shasta. They just on Friday interviewed someone else on Dream Soar, one of our Dream Team members named Jessica Ortega, who's just an amazing powerhouse young woman as well. I was able to connect them to NASA astronaut Nicole Stott, who I met last year and who has become a friend. I've also introduced them to someone I was extremely fortunate to meet 11 years ago now and have remained in contact with, Nicole Malachowski, who was the first female Air Force Thunderbird pilot and still the first female pilot for any military performance team, including the Blue Angels. So it's just been amazing to connect these folks. And the way I met Behedu is I'm also supporting an organization, a film company in Hollywood area that is producing a film called Fly Girls, the series, which will be a TV dramatic miniseries telling for the first time, really, the true story of the women Air Force service pilots, the WASP from World War II. And that's how I met Bea Haidu and several other of the WASP, is I helped them put together a very large fundraiser event here in 2016 in the San Diego area to advertise this film. And we did an amazing panel called the Greatest Generation Meets the Next Generation, where we had Bea Haidu and two other WASP, Alice Rohr Stevens and Beverly Biesmeyer, together on a panel similar to yours. But in addition to the WASP were four or five women who were recently separated from the military, flying for all the services. So we had the first fighter pilot from the Marines. We had amazing women on this panel, just casually chatting as you and I are, about sharing stories about what it was like for the WASP when they were flying all those aircraft in World War II, and what it was like for some of these other women in modern day military times. So I probably get more joy than anything out of connecting folks from my different facets of my life and having just amazing things come out of it.
So a simple question to ask, but a very difficult one to answer. Over eight decades ago, Amelia Earhart saw something that nobody else saw, and she started the revolution. Now in modern times, women like Shasta, women like astronaut Abby, Jessica Cox, Amelia Rose Earhart, Emily Calandrelli, Dr. Anita Sengupta, have taken those reins and launched the revolution into the stratosphere. In your eyes, what needs to be done in order for the STEM revolution to continue?
That's a really great question, Chris. And I think personally, it's twofold. One side of it is to continue doing what we've been talking about today, which is get people out in front of young girls to let them know what career fields are possible, what education they might want to pursue in order to reach those goals. Again, whether it's to be a pilot or an aircraft mechanic or a mechanical engineer, a scientist, whatever it is they want to do. It feels like to me that the school system has still not gotten to the point where guidance counselors understand that themselves. You know, when I was in high school in the 70s, my guidance counselors didn't help at all. And I don't mind, I'm not saying this to brag, I'm saying this as a data point. My high school graduating class in Arizona was a little over 700 students. I was the third in my class to graduate. I was the top 0.1% or something. Even at that level in my school, I still had really no help from the guidance counselors. I had one teacher who was extremely supportive of me career-wise. And in fact, we're still in touch. We're on Facebook together, which is just hilarious. She was my AP Advanced Placement English teacher, and she's an amazing woman. But no one told me what was possible. And here I was, you know, being offered full scholarships, and no one really helped me with my direction at all, which it sounds like from talking to young kids today, that's still the case. So I think a lot of it is continuing to get people like Shasta, like some other amazing friends I have, out in front of young kids to let them know what they can do and to provide mentorship and provide guidance to them. On the flip side, I think what really needs to be done, and I do know one organization here in San Diego who's trying to do this, I think there needs to be more education of the teachers and potentially parents, but more so of the teachers. I am hooked up with a couple of amazing guys here in San Diego who have an organization called Aero Ed, and what they're trying to do is meet up with teachers and help them understand aviation and airspace to be able to bring real world application examples into the classroom. So they're offering for teachers to come and get a free flight, you know, in a Cessna. They're offering them to, you know, sit at simulators and understand what it's like to fly an airplane so that they can go back into math class, they can go back into science class, they can go back into physics class and have a little more understanding of what it might be like to be a pilot, to be an engineer, to be able to translate that to the kids. There's not enough of that at all, in my opinion. There are some select high schools in the country and even some middle schools that do have aviation programs now. So I think it's starting, but educating the educators is, I think, the other piece of it that isn't talked about enough. I was really thrilled when we got the call from that organization in Chicago where Shasta, as I mentioned earlier, it was an event called STEMCon where they had a STEM conference for, I believe, 700 educators. And they've been doing that for a while. And I think there needs to be more of that because we even get emails sometimes from teachers really wanting to get some help in how do I better prepare my students for what might lie ahead and help them get there. And I would love to see more organizations popping up to be able to help the school system more than they are today.
Well said. Jill, I just have one final question before we end tonight. This is Chasing Earhart after all, so we'll end with this. What, in your eyes, is the legacy of Amelia Earhart in 2018?
The primary thing that strikes me about Amelia Earhart and always has is just that she not only never let anyone tell her no, but that she really did things her own way and figured out her own path. You know, as we mentioned earlier, she you know, the famous story is the first time she saw an airplane, she kind of went, you know, that's interesting, or maybe not even interesting. But once she got the bug, as all of us aviators eventually do, I think that the fact that she really did whatever she felt was aligned with her personality to get there, the fact that she dressed differently and didn't care what people said about her. I remember reading about the first time she decided to cut her hair short and didn't care what people said about her. I think what strikes me most about her, because I've never fit into anyone's mold of what a person should be, no matter what the category. You know, I've been told I'm not a normal engineer because I'm not necessarily as geeky as some of them are. You know, I've been told I'm not a normal fill in the blank most of my life. And I've never tried to fit into any mold either. And to me, that's what struck me about Amelia, and a message that I hope others will take on, is that you really don't have to fit into anyone else's definition of what you should be, regardless of what your goals are. You know, Amelia completely found her own path, and when things didn't go her way, she figured out how to make that next step anyway, the same way I've done it, the same way Shasta has done it, and the same way that quite a few of the women that I have met and some of the young girls I'm mentoring right now have done it. It's just a matter of figuring out really where you want to go and crashing through all the barriers. And if you have to take a turn that most people think isn't the right turn and you just know in your heart it's the way to go, just do it anyway. And I really think that Amelia was the first woman that I ever read about who really did that very strongly. So that was her personal inspiration to me, is to just really find your own path and don't try to fit into anyone else's box.
The website is www.dreamsoar.org. And Jill, thank you for being here with me for a little while tonight. And thank you for being my friend. It's a pleasure to know you.
Thank you, Chris. The feeling's mutual.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart Project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.